Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Paul Ronalds. Paul leads Save the Children Global Ventures, the new in-house team at Save the Children responsible for taking innovative finance and new technologies to scale. He brings a unique mix of private sector, government, and NGO experience to this initiative. Paul started his career as a corporate lawyer, has served as a senior advisor to two Australian prime ministers, was deputy CEO of World Vision Australia, and for the last 9 years, served as CEO of Save the Children Australia. He led the creation of and is a founding director of Save the Children Australia's Impact Investment Fund. Paul, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk today. I am really super excited to have you on the show today because impact investing is something that has been in the sector now for a while. You read about it, you see it. People don't necessarily really understand what it is or how it's really affecting the third sector. So welcome to the podcast. Looking forward to chatting today.
Wonderful to be here, Sabrina. Thanks for the invitation.
Before we get into the subject today, for people who aren't familiar with you or the work that you're doing, can you just introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners? Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into the third sector, and what you're doing now.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm currently the CEO of a new entity that Save the Children has created called Save the Children Global Ventures. And really, it's come from a range of work that Save the Children has done right around the world over the last few years in finding new forms of funding for our work and trying to take new technologies to scale. Before that, I was the CEO of Save the Children in Australia and the Pacific. I was the CEO there for nearly 9 years, but I got there the long way around. I started off life as a corporate lawyer in Australia doing corporate transactions, venture capital, equity transactions, purchases and sales of businesses, those sorts of things for a large global law firm. I then moved into the technology sector doing startups in the first.com boom, if you're old enough to remember that, before moving into the not-for-profit sector. I spent time in Canberra, the capital of Australia, working for two prime ministers running social policy before coming back to Melbourne to run Save the Children.
I love it. You're a fellow lawyer. We're using our powers for good and not evil, Paul. I love it.
That's right. We've got a lot of sins to atone for, Sabrina.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. We do. A long list of them. Let's just jump in and talk about impact investing. Can you just start in a broad sense? What is it? Where did it come from? Why is everybody talking about it now? What is it designed to do?
Well, it's actually got a reasonably long history, and perhaps the best way to explain what impact investing is to say what it's not. So, of course, many investors are now starting to, I guess, avoid harm from their investment portfolio, and they'll run what's called a negative screen over their investments. And that negative screen is essentially designed to prevent them from investing in things that might not be aligned with their values. If they are concerned around climate change, it might screen out oil and gas businesses. If they're concerned, for example, like Save the Children, around children's involvement in supply chains, it might screen out companies with a poor record there. It might screen out gambling or armaments or whatever it might be. So if you like, that's the sort of early avoid harm with your investment approach. That then went into a lens that looked over the sort of environmental, social, and governance aspects of any investment. This was not so much to have a positive impact, but again, to be thinking about investments in a holistic way. So as well as the financial metrics of any investment, people started thinking about, is this firm well governed? Does it have a license to operate with the communities in which it depends? Is its environmental practices strong? And that wasn't done so much to have any sort of strong non-financial impact, but from a belief that if you were concerned around those sorts of factors, you're more likely to have an overall successful investment portfolio. Impact investing goes further than those. The deepest impact investments are actually trying to contribute to solutions to some of the world's most significant social and environmental problems. And that's the space where Save the Children Global Ventures, of course, is operating. We began our first commercial impact investment fund in Australia now more than 3 years ago, which was the first impact investment fund run by a charity in Australia. And interestingly, the first child-focused deep impact investment fund in the world. So we're really proud of it. It's made 8 investments into 7 different initiatives, all of them aligned with Save the Children's mission. So this is education, health, and child protection. And they're all essentially trying to solve or help contribute to Save the Children's mission just in a different way.
That's really interesting, Paul. And I'm trying to make sure that I understand impact investing versus venture capital versus grant making. So you said you've made 8 investments. You're not making grants. You're actually investing in companies or organizations. Are these for-profit companies?
Yeah, so they can be for-profit or not-for-profit companies. So if they're not-for-profit, obviously they don't have shares or an equity structure. So the investment needs to be via debt or some form of debt. But for the most part, we've made equity investments into for-profit enterprises that are aligned with Save the Children's mission. And Sabrina, it might be helpful just to sort of step back and say, well, hang on, why is Save the Children involved in impact investing at all? What's wrong with sort of our traditional grants and philanthropy work? And I guess that's where we began at Save the Children, saying, well, actually, if we look at the available resources for addressing Save the Children's mission, and if we look at the need that we're seeing, particularly in a post-COVID world affected by conflict and climate change, we can actually see this massive growing gap between the available resources and the available need. And we're really confident that we're simply not going to get there with traditional fundraising approaches being philanthropy and grants. We've got to unlock significant new forms of funding that we can use to help achieve our mission. And when we look globally around where are those big funding pools, impact investing is one of the largest. And so there's various estimates. The latest one by the Global Impact Investing Network suggests that there's about $1 trillion of financial resources that are invested into impact investments. And that's a huge funding pool for an organization like Save the Children to start to think about, well, how can we use some of that money alongside grants and philanthropy, of course. Grants and philanthropy will continue to be a really critical part of, say, the children's sources of funding. But to complement those traditional forms of funding, how can we use impact investing to help us achieve our mission? And so that's why we've started to get involved in impact investing. And it also starts to answer your question around how is it different? Really, from our perspective, there's a spectrum of different forms of capital or funding that we want to use to achieve our mission. At one end, where there is, if you like, no return to the investor other than maybe a tax deductible donation or a sense of fulfilling a purpose, is your philanthropy end. And then at the other end is a commercial impact investment fund. We've actually also established a sort of intermediate stage with an endowment fund called the Children's Impact Multiplier Fund. It's funded by donations, not investments, but it's intended to operate just like one of our commercial impact investment funds. And the idea is that that gives us a full spectrum of capital to apply to the problem that we're trying to solve.
That's so interesting what you're talking about, the spectrum of sort of philanthropy to full commercial, because I think this is where I get a little bit lost and a little bit confused. When I've read about impact investing, my question, I guess, comes back to, I know you have your investing funding and then your outcome funding. Could you just talk a little bit about the structure of an impact fund? What does it look like and how does money go in and then how and when does money come out if it's an investment, so to speak?
Yeah, so there's generally speaking 2 broad types of impact fund. There's what's called a closed-ended fund or an ongoing fund. The fund that we have established in Australia is a closed-ended fund. That is, we go out to investors and raise money, usually takes about 12 months to put all of the various funding contributions together. And that funding is locked up effectively for a period of time. In our case, it's a 10-year closed-ended fund. So it's 10 years before investors can take their money back out. And that gives us a reasonably long length of time to, first of all, deploy the capital of the fund. So it takes us probably 3, perhaps even up to 4 years to fully deploy all of the capital that's been promised. And we draw down the capital from the investors over that period of time. We then work with the investment companies for many years before looking to exit our investments towards the end of the 10-year closed-ended fund period of time. There are open-ended funds that usually have some form of restrictions on how easily it is for an investor to withdraw their funds. There might be some limitation on the total amount, or it might be some sort of limitation on the notice period or requirement of a notice period. But in those cases, investors can access their funding or at least a portion of their funding at any time.
Where do you typically find the funds? Is this private venture capitals, hedge funds? Is this just private individual money that is interested in doing this? Could small people who invest in the stock market invest in something like this? Where do you go to find the initial funds?
So it varies depending on the market. Different markets, if you like, are at different levels of maturity, I would say, in relation to impact investing. In Australia, there was a lot of interest in, say, the Children's Impact Investment Fund, but I would say that the Australian market is still relatively immature, and there were very few of what I would call truly impact first investors. Instead, there were investors who said, I still want the same financial returns as I would expect from a purely non-impact commercial fund, but I would like to have impact on top of that. And in one sense, they're the worst investors, Sabrina, because they're often looking for the impact elements of the investment to be in addition to the fully commercial pieces without any sort of sense that actually it costs money and a lot of effort and energy to be able to generate really strong and measurable impact returns. What we were looking for in Australia is truly impact first investors, people who of course wanted a commercial return, but actually were most concerned around having their money contribute, as I said, to a solution, particularly in our case, aligned with Save the Children's mission of educating children, improving their health or protecting them from violence. And actually it became pretty hard to find them. We were very fortunate that QBE, which is one of Australia's largest insurance companies, have a particular product with their insurance called Premiums for Good, where their promise to their customers who take out an insurance product in the Premiums for Good space is that their premiums will be invested in impact investments. And so they were particularly excited about investing in our fund. We went through their due diligence process and they invested as one of our cornerstone investors. Save the Children Australia also put some of its balance sheet funding into this, which I think is great. And perhaps we can come back to not-for-profits investing in investment capital. But one of my issues in the not-for-profit space is that not-for-profits have often quite significant assets, assets that were contributed to the not-for-profit to help them achieve their mission, but they're often not working for their mission in the same way as other parts of the organization are. And I think all not-for-profits have a responsibility to make sure that they're using the full range of resources that they have available to achieve their mission, and impact investing gives them an opportunity to do that. So we had Save the Children, we had QBE, we had a range of private wealthy people who had an impact first mentality. We didn't go out to the general public. The products that Save the Children is selling are usually restricted to what we call professional or wholesale investors. And that's because the regulatory environment in which we're operating is much more simple for when you're engaging with those sorts of investors, as opposed to the sorts of requirements that are required for broad-based investors. But at the Australian market, the European market, however, more mature, much more orientated towards impact, and in fact, a growing level of institutional interest in impact investing, which is why towards the end of 2023, we're looking to launch our first European-based impact investment fund.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful to hear. I mean, I was curious because, you know, impact is one word and investing is another word. And a lot of people, when they think about investments, they think about a return, because otherwise then it's just philanthropy, right? Or like you were saying, it's maybe just a tax write-off. I was looking through the Global Ventures website and there's a lot of focus on impact first. So when you are measuring impact in order to determine whether there is a commercial payout or just whether or not that investment was successful, how do you measure impact in the impact investing space?
Yep, that's a great question. And it's a really important issue because I think there's been sort of increasing concern in the impact investing space about what's called impact washing, where people essentially bundle up existing investments that might be good investments. They might have a very small, perhaps carbon footprint, or they might have very limited supply chains or whatever it might be. They put an impact investment label on it. But actually, they're really just traditional investments without any sort of significant harm elements to them. Not what I would call true impact investments, and certainly not deep impact investments. Save the Children, however, really wants to be at the other end of that, what we call, as I said, deep impact investing. And what that means is that we apply a range of different criteria to whether or not an investment is right for us. So the first criteria is to look at the sustainable development goals and to say, does this investment address one of the sustainable development goals? And in Save the Children's case, we're particularly interested in education and health and the protection of children. We then go to the next level down and say, how is this investment and this business, if you like, this enterprise, how is it measuring the impact that it's having in health or education or child protection? How rigorous is the way that it goes about measuring that? How ambitious is it? What's the extent of its impact? There's a whole range of characteristics, if you like, that our due diligence process goes through to really understand both the current level of measurement of their impact, but also their future ambition and future potential of impact. We report on that quarterly back to our investors to make sure that they have a really strong sense of the impact that we're having. And we've seen that mature over time. So because we're often investing in very early stage businesses, what's appropriate in terms of impact measurement for an early stage business might be quite different from what it is as that business matures. And our expectations grow as the business itself develops and becomes more sophisticated. So not only do we work out what we want to do from the beginning, but we also look at how our impact measurement will develop over time with a particular investment.
Us a little bit about a few of these 8 investments that you've made so far from the fund. How do you find these social ventures? How do you pick them? And what are some of the ones doing now that you've invested in so far?
Yeah, this sort of discussion can often seem a bit esoteric until you start to really provide some concrete examples. So let me give you a couple. The first one is a business called ThinkMD. ThinkMD is a business based in the United States. It was founded by some very capable children's doctors in Boston who had done a lot of work in developing countries and particularly work with community health workers. And they realized that if they applied some really smart software to children and maternal health diagnosis, they could help community health workers become much more effective at diagnosing those issues and therefore have impact that way. Now, from a Save the Children perspective, this is a really significant opportunity because we mostly indirectly support about 600,000 community health workers globally. These are people generally relatively low educated, probably haven't had much more than a few years of primary school education that we provide some basic healthcare training to. They're usually employed by local ministries of health, and they're really frontline health workers in villages and communities in very low income contexts. Giving them the ThinkMD technology, usually on some sort of tablet, will take them from being, as I said, helpful in their community, but perhaps nowhere near as effective as a doctor, to between 90 and 95% as effective as a US doctor in diagnosing child and maternal health. So we get probably a 2 or 3 times increase in the productivity of this workforce across Save the Children's various offices. That's a huge impact on Save the Children's mission, but it's a huge impact on the health of communities in which we're working. Now, of course, that doesn't mean the health issues are solved. You can get a great diagnosis, but there may not be medicine, for example, available in the local pharmacy, but it's the first stage towards getting a much better health outcome for the children and mothers that we're working with. So you can see with that example, the really enormous impact that it has. Save the Children were already piloting the ThinkMD technology in our Bangladesh office. That's how we became aware of ThinkMD. We were able to run our due diligence across ThinkMD in a real live situation because it was already deployed with our staff in the Bangladesh office. We could see how it worked. We could engage with the Bangladesh Ministry of Health to understand how they saw it. And off the back of all of that, we decided to invest. We own now about 10% of ThinkMD, and we're in the process of rolling it out, as I said, from a couple of Save the Children offices where it's been piloted to now more than 50 country offices to really scale up that impact, but also to have really strong financial outcomes. We will be paying ThinkMD a software license fee for every license they provide to us. They're written into the grants that we traditionally get from bilateral and multilateral agencies. And that way, it's also going to be a really significant financial outcome for ThinkMD.
That's really interesting. And that's a great example of an organization that Ventures has invested in. Let me ask you about conflict of interest here, though. I mean, some people listening, particularly I know the Mel folks that I know, will say, well, if you are investing in this company and you are also using them to implement projects, do you see any conflict of interest there? Or how is that conflict of interest addressed when it comes to selection?
Yeah, so there's the potential for conflict of interest there, as you say, between our interest in being able to promote the best partners as part of any sort of grant opportunity versus any sort of investment objectives that we might have. In the Global Ventures case, the decision making around that is completely separate. So traditionally, the procurement decisions are done by Save the Children International staff in country. They will look around to see what is the best partner to solve a particular part of a grant requirement that they might have. Global Ventures, of course, is a separate legal entity. We're a Swiss-based foundation. There is no obligation on any country office to include any of our portfolio companies in any of the grants they might be going for. So there's that sort of degree of separation. We also have a really rigorous procurement process in relation to any company where Save the Children or any part of Save the Children owns some of that entity. And again, there's a whole range of checks and balances. Of course, where we're going out and looking to apply for a grant, which is the general case, it's all very upfront from the donor's perspective. They, like any sort of grant situation Save the Children might be leading on, will spell out the partners that we think are best placed to apply for the grant with us. We'll spell out the relationships, their expertise, et cetera, et cetera. And it's up to the grantee to be confident, given that level of transparency, that everything is above board and appropriate.
You were talking a little bit about non-for-profits investing their own money in impact vehicles and things like that. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think that might also raise some eyebrows of people in the traditional charity and nonprofit world saying, well, we have this endowment, you know, for the ones that are lucky enough to have resources to be able to invest. Investing is risky. You hear all of the notices that come along when you see investing advertisements. Returns are not guaranteed. Invest at your own risk. Get expert advice. So what is your thinking around not-for-profits using investment as a way to further their mission?
Yeah, so I think the sort of starting point for this is that all of the resources that have been donated or accumulated over time that not-for-profits have access to have been given for the purposes of their mission. And in some cases, they're really quite significant. So if I think about the Australian context that I know best, there is about $50 billion of financial resources that are under management of trusts and foundations in Australia that are investable. And most impact investing conferences will look particularly at sort of trusts and foundations as being a really significant source of impact investment. And they should be. Too few trusts and foundations investing the full corpus behind their mission. Often, you know, they'll give away 4 or 5% of their corpus each year and pretty much ignore the 94, 95, 96% of their financial resources and the impact that they could have. But actually, that situation is even more significant for not-for-profits. There might be $50 billion of investable assets with trusts and foundations in Australia, but there is about $400 billion, so about 8 times that amount, on balance sheets of not-for-profits in Australia. Now, not all of that is investable. Lots of it is tied up in property or other assets that are required for the not-for-profit's mission. But as you say, a number of them do have significant investments, often just in bank accounts, long-term deposits. Some of them might have invested in bonds, and perhaps some of the more sophisticated might have them in some sort of alternative financial product that is giving them a longer-term return. It's those assets that I think need to be reviewed and for boards and management teams to consider whether actually they should be using those resources in a way that is more mission aligned, which of course is the responsibility of both the boards and the management team from an ethical perspective. I think all not-for-profits that have significant balance sheets should be thinking through whether impact investing aligned with their mission is one of the tools that they should be putting into their toolbox. The second part of that is there's actually also a really fantastic way to expand the engagement that you might have with your existing donors. What we found at Save the Children was that when we started going out to many of our existing donors that we had the deepest relationships with, they were really excited that Save the Children was getting involved in impact investing. And often they said, this is great, but it perhaps doesn't fit with what we want to do. We found that just that increased engagement led to more donations of a sort of traditional form, as well as the every one in 50 or so saying, yes, actually, we would like to invest in this fund alongside giving our donations. And I mentioned QBE earlier in the podcast. They were already a philanthropic donor to Save the Children. They were giving about $300,000 a year for humanitarian causes to Save the Children. And so they saw their investment in our impact investment fund as a way to expand their engagement with Save the Children. So it was really a win-win-win. win for us and for QBE.
That's fascinating. And I want to pick up on what you were just talking about with leadership and management and boards. But let's start with leadership and management. So if we have somebody who's listening to the podcast today who's saying, you know what, I think that there's some money available within my organization, you know, a nonprofit organization, that we should start looking at impact investing. What's the business case that can be made to leadership and management to get some of those funds out from just being stuffed under the mattress, so to speak, and into one of these cases? What are the opportunities, but then also what are some of the threats in that business case to start moving more of this money into an impact investment vehicle?
And so the biggest opportunity here is for the organization's mission to be making sure that you're applying all of the resources that you have under your control for the purposes of the mission. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to invest, you know, any of that spare cash into an impact investment fund. Obviously, there are things like liquidity. You'll need to understand your cash requirements. These impact investment funds, as I mentioned, are generally illiquid assets. So you have to be pretty confident that you're not going to need the money anytime soon. But if you do have funds where you might be investing into longer term assets, I think impact investments should absolutely be very much the top of your thinking. Now, are there issues? Yes. I've already mentioned that these funds tend to be illiquid. So you need to make sure that your cash flow situation is not going to require you to be able to access this funding anytime soon. The sorts of things that we're investing in do tend to be riskier than other forms of investment. So many not-for-profit boards have a requirement that investments can only be made into, you know, AA or AAA rated investments. That's not going to be something that aligns with most impact investment funds. They're going to be invested in riskier, earlier stage organizations where there is a greater potential for those funds to be lost. However, there's also the potential for greater financial returns. Last year, as I understand it, in the US, the average return on a venture capital fund was about 15%. And that's probably in line with many earlier stage impact investment funds. So there's an opportunity for some good returns, as well as, of course, the impact on the mission of the organization.
That's really interesting to hear that the returns are about the same of a venture capital fund. I feel like now we've sort of been around impact investing long enough that you can go back a few years and you can start to do the analysis with impact investing versus sort of more traditional investing, which is kind of nice to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, again, I'm talking in broad generalities, Sabrina. There's a very large spectrum. There are some impact investment funds where, you know, they are upfront and saying, actually, we're not seeking a, you know, market level type return. Instead, this is some form of concessional funding. On the other hand, many impact investment funds try and achieve a near commercial return similar to non-impact investment funds. Now, I do think, you know, and there is a bit of a debate here, do you have to accept some sort of financial trade-off to achieve the impact? And I think that, as I said earlier in the podcast, there are some investors that are a little bit naive thinking that you can have it all. Seldom in life can you have it all. And certainly if you're going to do rigorous impact measurement, that costs money. We see that in Save the Children all the time. You need quite specialist and significant skills, technical skills, to be able to measure the impact that you're having rigorously, and that costs money. So if you're genuinely interested in rigorous impact measurement, I think you should expect, as an impact investor, to be paying a premium for that, either in the fees or in the return. But, you know, the companies that we've invested in, we're expecting to, over the life of the fund, achieve a 10% per annum or better return for our investors.
That's great. And let's talk a little bit about boards now, too. Sort of similar question. If boards are faced with an opportunity or asked a question about impact investing, what should boards think about when it comes to risk and also when it comes to really the mission of the organization and looking at maybe new and different ways to achieve the mission of the organization, maybe the modern interpretation of that mission?
Yeah. So I think this is probably one of the areas that I have some concerns from my experience in the not-for-profit sector, Sabrina. I think too often not-for-profit boards are really focused around what I would describe as sort of the operational risks that they face, things like staff safety, fraud, in Save the Children's case, child safeguarding issues. And Absolutely. They're significant risks and they're critical issues that boards need to be concerned about. But I think that the most important risks that boards need to be focused around are whether or not that organization will achieve its mission. In an example like Save the Children, we're created to literally provide life-saving aid. And in that context, surely one of our most important risks is failing to achieve our mission. And so when I go and speak to my colleagues and say, okay, we've got really ambitious goals that every child globally gets a quality basic education, that no child dies before their fifth birthday and no child is subject to violence. And we've set the 2030 to achieve these goals. How many of you think that we're on track to achieve those three global goals and therefore our mission? And you can bet, Sabrina, that in any room full of Save the Children staff, no one puts their hands up. They see that the impact that increasing humanitarian crises, conflict, COVID, all of those issues are having. And we're deeply concerned about not achieving that mission. So if that's the case, then surely we should be absolutely focused about ensuring that all of the resources at our access are able to be applied to our mission and that we're scouring the world for the best new ways to intervene to have more impact. Again, in Save the Children's case, to have more impact on children's health or education or protection. And so I'd love to see boards far more focused around the risk of not achieving the organization's mission as compared to their operational risks. I also think that too often boards are focused on what we might see as a sort of the rapid onset crises, that those things that might come up out of the blue and have an impact, whether it might be a staff safety issue or whatever it is, versus those long-term strategic risks that are changing the fundamental drivers for achieving the organization's mission. I see too few boards really focused around those strategic changes, long-term strategic changes. And innovative finance is one of those. We are seeing globally a lot more interest in using innovative finance mechanisms, loan mechanisms, climate finance, impact investing, concessional or blended finance forms, as opposed to those traditional grants and philanthropy type opportunities. And boards that are not thinking through how they adjust their business model to be able to leverage some of those new funding opportunities, again, I don't think are doing the right thing. And then the third issue is culture. Organizational culture is, it's hard to measure, but it's a bit like a tea bag in my view. When you put it in some hot water, you soon know how strong or otherwise it is. And I think too often, particularly in the aid and development sector, the culture of organizations is very compliance orientated. It's very risk averse, when actually we need to be really thinking through how we have those dramatic increases in the impact of our organization to achieve our mission. And so I would be encouraging boards of not-for-profits to think much more about mission, think much more about strategic risk, and to think much more about organizational culture.
I love it, Paul. I love it. And first of all, I love the culture is like teabag. I think that's great. I've never heard that before. That is brilliant. I'm totally stealing that from you. But yeah, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. So many times with organizations that I've worked with, I see boards and senior leadership thinking about risk more from a compliance and a tick box point of view than actually standing back and saying, are we going to achieve our objectives? And people who have listened to my podcast before and have read some of my writing know my focus on objective-centered risk management. If we start there, if we start by saying, what are we trying to achieve? And we work our way out from there, you're going to be in such a better place strategically, vision-wise, tacticals, you know, I mean, all of that. So I agree 100%. And, you know, I do hope that, I know that fundraising right now is so challenging for nonprofits, particularly in the UK. Cost of living is going up, economies are slowing, people who are responsible for raising funds are saying how difficult it is out there. And I'm wondering if maybe thinking about some of these new and innovative ways to get funds into these programs that are so crucial, maybe really the future, maybe the way things are going.
Well, I think it's certainly part of the solution. Grants and philanthropy will always be important, and we need to continue to make sure that we're doing our very best and convincing people to be more generous in that way. But I think certainly for larger organizations like Save the Children, you need to think about how you can complement that traditional philanthropy and grant making with some of these other forms of innovative finance. And again, it's a sort of vague term that can mean lots of things, but when it comes down to it, it can be quite simple. I mean, Save the Children recently, we wanted to upgrade our global fleet of vehicles. As you can imagine, with about 120 countries around the world, about 2,500 programs being run at any one time, there's a lot of vehicles where whether that be cars, motorbikes, even boats being used to deliver our programs. We found when we looked at that fleet that it was aging, that it didn't meet our minimum staff safety requirements and that its carbon footprint was much higher than what it should have been. And so we set about putting in place a new fleet management process and investing in upgrading our fleet. Now, that required about $6 million globally to do that. Now, we could have used our reserves, we could have used philanthropy, we could have applied for further grants in relation to that. But actually, we saw that as an opportunity to use loans, a concessional loan, to be able to do that. The loan effectively was backed by grants from governments around the world. So actually, it was a pretty low risk investment from the lender's perspective. And we did the transaction when interest rates were still relatively low. So we were able to secure loans at about 3% for that $6 million that we needed. Now, that's then set about rejuvenating that fleet, but it hasn't taken away from any of that precious philanthropy and grant money that we needed to apply to, you know, a humanitarian crisis in Yemen or Syria or wherever it might have been. So again, a simple loan mechanism there, much better than competing with our traditional funding forms.
That's really interesting. I really encourage people who are listening today to learn more about all these different options out there, because exactly what you're saying, Paul, you don't have to dip into that precious project-focused funds if there's other things that your organization needs to do. That's so interesting. So what do you think the future holds for impact investing? Do you think that these tools will still be around the periphery, or will they start moving more towards commercial? Will you be able to get, for example, a teachers union pension fund to invest in an impact investing tool? Or is this still going to be kind of the space for trusts and foundations?
No, I think we're going to see impact investing become increasingly mainstream. It's been interesting, even with some of the recent economic volatility, the significant reductions that we've seen in what might be traditional venture capital funding, impact investing hasn't declined by anywhere near the same amount, which suggests just how strong the underlying interest in it is. That said, I do think that concerns around impact washing are going to grow. I was in Europe recently, and every impact investor I spoke to wanted to talk about impact measurement and impact washing and how we were addressing those issues. So I think impact investing is going to become much more sophisticated about the tools and frameworks that it applies to measure and manage and report on the impact that it's creating. I'm also hopeful that it won't just be a few organizations like Save the Children that are looking to leverage this impact investing to support their mission. I think large organizations like Save the Children are in a unique impact investing opportunity. We have these extraordinary networks and relationships that can be a source of what's called pipeline investable opportunities. We are able to do due diligence on the companies that we're interested in, unlike most other venture capitalists. I mean, when we do, for example, due diligence on an education technology business in Kenya, I'm able to consult our global education technology team. I'm able to consult our education specialists in Kenya. They're able to introduce me to the Ministry of Education in Kenya to do another layer of due diligence. This sort of due diligence is just not available to most mainstream impact investors. So we're in a unique position there. And then, of course, post-investment, organizations like Save the Children are able to add extraordinary value to the investments that they make that are aligned with their mission. So I'm hopeful that we'll see more not-for-profits like Save the Children getting involved in impact investing, more investors taking it seriously, and particularly taking the measurement of impact more seriously over time. I'm pretty optimistic.
That's great. We could do a whole nother episode, Paul, on due diligence. I would love to get into that with you maybe in the future. I want to move on to ongoing education. You have really educated me so much on the episode so far. So if there's folks who are listening today who are really fascinated by this and they'd like to learn more, are there any continuing education resources that you can recommend? Hopefully low resource, no resource, you know, they don't have to go back and get a master's in finance or anything like that. Any platforms, other podcasts, reading materials, communities of practice that people could reach out to or take advantage of to learn more about impact investing and maybe creative finance?
Yeah, so there's an increasing number of courses being run around the world around innovative finance and impact investing, including targeting people working at not-for-profits. So people can absolutely have a look at that if they're really serious. But if I was someone who's just sort of starting out, my first port of call would be the Global Impact Investing Network website. It's called GIIN, G-I-I-N, go to that website. They've got a vast array of free resources that's available there on impact investing. They are really the sort of leaders in putting together some of the tools and frameworks for measuring impact. And so I would start there. The other space that I would go to would be the DevEx daily email and website. DevEx is a great source of innovative finance news. It'll give you insights into what organizations like Save the Children and Oxfam and Mercy Corps and CARE are all doing in this space, what funders like USAID or the World Bank or whoever it might be, how they're engaging in innovative finance. Lots of resources there as well. So that'd be the first two places I would go to.
Wonderful. That's really helpful. And if people are interested in learning more about Global Ventures or interested in reaching out to you, how can people learn more?
Yes. Yeah, so please jump onto our website, scgv.org, and you'll see there that we've also got a range of different publications and links across to other podcasts that I've done, news articles, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a great place to keep connected with us. Otherwise, reach out to us via LinkedIn. I've gone off Twitter a little bit with Elon Musk's takeover. I'm not quite as active as I used to be there. So LinkedIn is the main way to stay connected, both with Save the Children Global Ventures and with me personally.
Great. Wonderful. Final words, anything that we didn't cover, any more words of wisdom about impact investing or organizations that may be more curious about it or want to get involved? What would you advise?
Well, I would advise stay curious. We are in a really fast changing aid and development sector. The pressures on our sector have never been greater in the two decades that I've been involved. And with that pressure building, there's got to be reform and change. And so I would encourage anyone that's interested in solving some of these large global aid and development challenges to really stay curious, stay connected, and be open to trialing and piloting some of these new ways of working, some of these new business models for your organization.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Paul, for your time today. I have learned so much, and I wish you all the luck with Global Ventures. It sounds like such an exciting organization and a really, really impactful area of work for the third sector.
Thanks, Sabrina. It's been great to be on the podcast.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.